more than half a century, governments across the globe bought encryption devices from Switzerland. What they didn't know? The CIA was behind the sale.
We, the United States, had the capacity to listen in on some of the worst actors in the world, and there's still open question about what do we do with that?
Also, one man was a white supremacist, another a Muslim supremacist, but they escaped extremist movements thanks to a support group run by this woman.
We believe that all kind of extremism really work the same way. I wish people really understood that.
And no soil, no problem. They're turning mattresses into gardens in a refugee camp in Jordan.
We're going to be able to grow stuff all over. We'll be able to turn these beds into green beds, and everyone can have their own garden.
I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us today. It has been called the intelligence coup of the century. Countries thought they were buying encryption equipment from a Swiss company, but there were other secret owners, the CIA and the German intelligence agency, that made it easy for U.S. spies to steal secrets from dozens of governments, both enemies and allies, during and after the Cold War. We know much more about this vast operation because of a new report from the Washington Post and the German public broadcaster, ZDF. We're going to drill down into a few facets of the scheme, including what it meant for U.S. collaboration with Latin American dictatorships. Fortunately, the non-governmental National Security Archive has already done some drilling. Tom Blanton, the head of the archive, explains what the new documents reveal.
These countries were paying money effectively back to the CIA and the West German intelligence for the privilege of letting their supposedly secret communications be read by the Americans and the Germans. So extraordinary. Millions of dollars actually came into both the CIA and the German coffers to pay for more secret intelligence operations.
We have to remember too, Tom, that this was all happening when some really ruthless dictators were running countries across much of Latin America. If the U.S. spies had access to the raw communication of these regimes, what dark chapters of history might we now be able to learn more about?
Boy, that's a great question, and I think that's the next shoe to drop. Neither one of these leaked histories, neither the German one nor the CIA one, apparently give many details of the impact, like what the countries were able to find out ahead of time. There are a couple, like the U.S. negotiations over the Iranian hostages. But the documents we published yesterday, kind of following on the Washington Post story, show that all these Operation Condor countries, these Southern Cone military dictatorships that were assassinating their opponents around the world, like Orlando Letelier right here in Washington, or throwing people out of helicopters into the ocean like in Argentina's Dirty War, that entire Condor operation was using these crypto AG machines. So it raises the question, did the United States have opportunities to intervene and stop some of these atrocities, or did it just choose to keep the stream of intelligence coming, not wanting to jeopardize that? That's what we've got to get at, which is under all this, there's a huge record of these decrypts that could really open that really sordid history, especially in Latin America.
What are the odds, Tom, that these raw communications will ever be declassified and see the light of day? And what about justice for people like the families of Argentines who were thrown out of planes into the ocean?
There are trials right now in Argentina, for example, of military perpetrators who did those kinds of abuses. And we've been sending there and sending our staff down there to testify, sending documents down there we've gotten through the Freedom of Information Act. What's interesting about these revelations this week is that somebody leaked these histories, and they're internal histories where the story is one of, wow, we won, aren't we brilliant, we're great. And from a pure intelligence perspective or realist perspective of American national security advantage, they're absolutely right. But there's a separate set of ethical dilemmas that also get raised by these revelations. They're similar to ethical dilemmas throughout intelligence gathering. Your goal as a spy is to get somebody on the other side to commit treason, right? Mm. To do immoral things. This is a – John le Carré writes about this in every one of his books. Here you have this whole interesting dynamic where – we, the United States, had the capacity to listen in on some of the worst actors in the world, and there's still open question about what do we do with that?
There is a parallel here to another big story in the news today. I'm talking about the raging debate about Chinese tech giant Huawei. It's one of the world's biggest mobile phone makers. The concern from the White House and others is that using Huawei equipment in next-generation 5G phone networks opens countries up to spying by the Chinese government. But do these revelations about crypto AG make that alarm seem hypocritical? What do you think?
Not so much hypocritical as another red flag. The vulnerabilities of all of us on privacy grounds keep going up all the time with our adoption of high-tech equipment, smartphone, location data, for example. The Huawei, I think, outcry will actually be encouraged by these revelations about crypto AG, because if a ostensibly neutral company based in Switzerland that is the leading provider of crypto machines around the world could be secretly hacked in this way, then, yeah, we all need to have our eyes open.
Tom Blanton heads the non-governmental National Security Archive. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Marco. It's a pleasure.
Let's stick with Huawei for a few more minutes. U.S. officials have been saying for a while that using Huawei equipment in mobile networks poses a national security threat. And today we know why Washington is so worried. The world's Lydia Emanuelito is in the studio with me. So, Lydia, what specifically are U.S. officials now saying Huawei is up to?
Okay, so Marco, if you're a telecom equipment maker like Huawei, you have to, by law, build backdoors into your technology. And those backdoors are used mostly by law enforcement during investigations. So, you know, they can get in and see people's communications. You have to get a warrant or a court order for that. Different countries have different laws. But very few people are supposed to be able to access those backdoors. What the U.S. is saying is that Huawei secretly gave itself access to those backdoors in the networks where their equipment is being used. And we should say here that the Wall Street Journal was first to report on the U.S. intelligence that officials say shows Huawei had this capability for years.
So has Huawei actually used those backdoors, and to what end?
U.S. officials wouldn't say whether they have, but the concern is that they could use them to spy on people's personal communications and their data. And the Trump administration has made it clear that it's not just Huawei they're worried about. They've called the company, quote, an instrument of the Chinese government. So the concern is that Huawei would spy on behalf of the Chinese government. Huawei denies all of this. They told me in a statement that these are, quote, lies being spread by U.S. officials.
So given that we don't really know if and how Huawei is using these backdoors, how significant is this intelligence coming from Washington?
I put that question to Josephine Wolf. She teaches cybersecurity at Tufts University.
The big deal here is not so much the information that's been released, because it's still very, very vague in a lot of ways, but the fact that the U.S. government is slowly starting to release a little more information about why they're so wary of Huawei equipment and what they're concerned about.
Marco, as you said earlier, for a long time, the U.S. has been pressuring countries like Britain, Germany to ban Huawei from their 5G networks, but they hadn't said anything about what concretely they're worried about.
So I do think it's sort of the beginning of what I hope will be the U.S. being more forthcoming about their concerns and the evidence that they've collected. But I don't think we're quite at the stage where it's possible to say, yes, this is a really big deal. All of these countries should be banning Huawei.
And Marco, it looks like the countries that the U.S. has brought this evidence to don't think it's that compelling either. Just a couple of weeks ago, Britain decided not to ban Huawei, despite, you know, lots of lobbying mm-hmm. from the U.S. And it's looking like Germany, another country Trump has been trying to convince to stay away from Huawei, also won't ban it. They're expected to vote on that in the next couple of weeks.
The world's Lydia Emanuelito. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
When should someone serving time for terror-related offenses get out of prison? That's a question British lawmakers are debating, because a lot of these prisoners are released after they serve just half of their sentences. London has seen two terrorist attacks since last November. In both cases, the perpetrators had been released from prison early. From London, the world's Orla Barry reports on new emergency legislation to end the policy of early release.
It was the middle of Sunday afternoon, February 2nd, when Sudesh Aman attacked passers-by with a knife.
A man has been shot dead by armed police on a busy high street in South London. Scotland Yard have declared the incident in Streatham this afternoon terrorist-related.
There were similarities to another incident in London less than 3 months ago. In both cases, the suspects were men acting alone. They wore fake suicide vests. and they attacked strangers on the street. Both men had also served prison time for terrorism-related offences, and both were let out of jail under the automatic early release policy. The Mayor of London City, Khan, lives 5 minutes from the scene of the most recent attack.
What makes me angry is, in my view, both these attacks were both foreseeable and preventable.
Khan is one of many politicians now raising questions about why terrorism suspects are being let out of jail halfway through their sentences. The policy was put in place 15 years ago to deal with overcrowding. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is promising to do away with the practice.
We do think it's time to take action to ensure that people convicted of terrorist act offences in the current stream do not qualify automatically for early release.
New legislation is one way to keep convicted terrorists in prison for longer. But here's one problem. British jails can be a breeding ground for radicalisation, says Ian Atchison. He's a former prison administrator.
You've got overcrowding, you've got indecent conditions, so there's a lot of frustration, and you've got a ready supply of highly credulous, violent young men coming into custody serving long sentences for non-terrorist related crimes who are in search of excitement and meaning.
Atchison is now an advisor on counter-terrorism. He says radicalised prisoners should be isolated from the rest of the prison population, and he doubts whether the current intervention programmes are working.
We've got to be extremely sceptical if these people are capable of change, and terrorist offenders are laughing at the crudity and the ineffectiveness of what we call our de-radicalisation programmes.
But others say this sort of criticism is unfair. Rashad Ali is a counter-terrorism practitioner. He's worked on de-radicalisation initiatives with former prisoners.
There are many instances which we know individuals who have been released for many, many years now that were involved in very serious plots, who have a different way of thinking, a way of feeling, a way of belonging and connecting to other people. So I think there are many instances which we can demonstrate that this does actually work.
Right now, more than 220 people are serving time for terrorism-related offences in British jails, and at least 50 of them are up for early release. One recent study found that just over 3% of those released in recent years went on to be convicted of another terrorism-related crime. Law Professor Stuart MacDonald of Swansea University says this new emergency bill may be problematic.
I think it's highly likely to be subject to challenge on human rights ground in terms of the European Convention on Human Rights, Article 7, and changing a person's sentence whilst they are in the process of serving that sentence, I think, could be subject to challenge under that article.
Others say the issue is not just about sentencing laws. It's about preventing people like Sudesh Aman and the London Bridge attacker Usman Khan, both born in Britain, from becoming radicalised in the first place. Former prison official Ian Atchison says the real solution comes long before someone gets arrested.
Why are born and bred British citizens murdering other citizens on our streets? We've got to see if there is a way that we can change our approach across communities to drive out that sort of hateful ideology and to defeat it.
Atchison says a lot of that will fall on the shoulders of Muslim community leaders. Rashad Ali agrees the religious leaders need to play a role, but there's a deeper problem.
We're talking about people that are disenfranchised from the mainstream Islamic community and wider society. These are people who don't have necessarily that much confidence in these people. They have a political worldview which separates them from institutions, from wider society, that says, actually, all these people are against us. And that's something that is obviously going to be a challenge for anybody seeking to reach out to these people.
The next prisoner up for early release was convicted in 2018 for expressing support of ISIS. He's due to be let out on February 28th. The government plans to put the new law in place the day before. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Later on the show, we hear from two former extremists who managed to get out of hate groups and are helping others not to get recruited. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The cause of the coronavirus outbreak is still a puzzle. Many scientists have pointed to a market in Wuhan, China, as a potential source, a place where hundreds of animals, many exotic species, were kept in cages surrounded by unsanitary conditions. Among the animals that researchers think may be the culprit, pangolins. an endangered, highly trafficked mammal. It looks like a pine cone with claws. John Epstein is with EcoHealth Alliance and researches emerging zoonotic viruses. And John, zoonotic viruses are ones that jump from animals to humans. And there's been a lot of talk about this wet market in Wuhan. Describe what these places are like. Why are they good places to begin to source the origin of a new virus? And why settle on pangolins?
In China, in urban settings, there are live animal markets that have all different kinds of species. A lot of domestic animals like ducks and geese or pigs, but also a lot of wildlife species. And these cages are often stacked one on top of another, and these animals are sold for food. So they're kept alive, they're sold fresh, and they're butchered in the market. The reason they're called wet markets is there's often live butchering going on, and you can see in the streets there's fur and blood and guts, and they often don't have the most hygienic conditions in terms of the mixing of bodily fluids from different animals. These are species of animals that perhaps would never encounter each other naturally in the wild, being brought from their natural habitat into an urban setting at high concentration where they're being handled by people and butchered. So that's a great opportunity, not only for viruses that these animals may be carrying to spread among the animals, but for people handling them to come in contact with bodily fluids, whether it's blood or urine or feces. If it gets on their hands and they're cutting up an animal, they may cut their skin and get infected that way, or simply by touching their eyes or nose or mouth, that's a great way to get exposed to a new virus. So it's a chain reaction. The dangers here are bringing in wild animals whose health status is unknown. We often know very little about the types of viruses or bacteria that animals might naturally be carrying, and you bring them into a very unnatural setting that creates the opportunity for these bacteria or viruses to get out of those animals and into people. Now, the question of pangolins, we haven't really seen a lot of data yet to support the idea that pangolin viruses are involved. There's been discussion in public about studies that haven't been published yet that pangolins may have similar coronavirus, a portion of which is found in the genome or the genetics of the coronavirus causing the current outbreak. But until those studies are published in peer-reviewed journals, it's very difficult to assess the validity of that assertion that pangolins are involved.
What's the downside of a presentation of even a suspected animal like the pangolin before we know for sure?
What you don't want to see happen is people out of fear seeking to exterminate or kill animals that they think might be associated with a human illness. It's not the wildlife's fault. These wild animals, they normally carry viruses and bacteria just like people do, but it's in fact human activities that bring us closer to wildlife that create opportunity for epidemics. And so it's very risky to implicate certain animals, particularly if there's no evidence yet, because it could cause retribution or backlash against those animals. And when it's something as endangered as pangolins, we certainly want to avoid that. And bats, too, they're so ecologically important that we really have to be careful about vilifying wildlife when we talk about human viruses.
Why is determining the animal host so important?
The simple answer to that is so we can prevent this from happening again. It's really important to understand the chain of events that leads to that first human infection or group of human infections that triggers an outbreak. If we don't know that, it's very hard to eliminate the risky behaviors or the risk factors involved in an epidemic happening.
So where does the investigation stand in China? Are researchers from around the globe able to get the samples and information from Wuhan they need to find answers?
Well, it's been challenging. Unfortunately, what hasn't come out yet and what really is needed is information about specifically which animals were present in that seafood market in Wuhan at the time those early cases were infected. What we know is that during the investigation, they did sample animals and they also collected environmental samples. These would be swabs of surfaces, tabletops or chairs, maybe drains. And they found that of about 580 samples collected across the market, 37 of them were positive, meaning that they detected genetic material from this coronavirus in samples around a part of the market that was known to have wildlife vendors. So we know that there's environmental contamination with this virus in a part of the market that sold wildlife. We know that animals that have been tested so far have been negative for this virus, but we don't know, unfortunately, which species were in the market, which ones were tested, and how many. And without that information, it's very difficult to understand the chain of events that led to the emergence of this virus.
John Epstein with EcoHealth Alliance in New York. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Remember quadratic equations? If you're not currently enrolled in a middle school math class, maybe you don't, but Poshen Lo does. He's a math professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, and he recently stumbled on a novel method of solving these equations. We won't get deep into the mechanics because it gets complicated, but you can check out a video of his method on our Facebook page. But here's what Lo found. His new method had been used before, like thousands of years ago.
The fact that I had never seen this approach before made me very surprised because it was so simple. And I actually immediately thought, surely there are other people who have come upon this idea or parts of this idea before. And as I went digging through the mathematical history all around quadratic equations, I was very happy to find out that 3,000 years ago, the Babylonians thought that the most reasonable way to solve the problem was to use this exact same trick.
So what is it like for you as a mathematician in the 21st century that you're using methods that are hundreds or even thousands of years old, like ancient Babylonian old?
It's actually an amazing rush whenever you can go and look at historical work and realize what people knew back then, and to be able to look at what they had written, translated of course, and to marvel about the fact that human knowledge can be preserved over thousands of years. When I found this out, I went to look at other resources too, not only Babylonian work, but also I wanted to find the work of somebody named Al-Khwarizmi. He was a Persian mathematician. And when you look at the work from this long ago, of course, the examples they have will not involve cars, but people were still human, and we were still trying to use mathematics to understand our life.
What are some of the practical applications of the quadratic equation?
One reason the Babylonians might have been interested in this a long time ago is because that particular problem of trying to find two numbers which have a given sum when you add them together and a given product when you multiply them comes if you're, for example, looking at rectangular land. I guess everyone wants to know how much land you have in your plot of land that you're farming, perhaps. And other things that make quadratics so important are that every single time you throw a ball in the air, or anything that's in free fall, is actually following Newton's laws of motion. Mm. And Newton's laws of motion cause the trajectories of what fall to come in the shape of what's called a parabola, which is actually what happens if you try to graph a quadratic expression.
From a teaching perspective, does approaching math problems in a different way change how people are comfortable with math? Does it make it less intimidating?
A lot of students who try to learn math by following methods that they've read in a book or learned from a teacher don't have the ability to solve a question that they've never seen before, because they'll say, well, nobody taught it to me, so how am I supposed to do it at all? And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to find a way to teach it in a way where students have to discover for themselves what to do to puzzle their way through it. And then if you learn math that way, actually all of math turns out to become quite easy.
Poshen Lo, math professor at Carnegie Mellon University, thank you very much.
Pleasure to be here.
You're listening to The World. Moving to a new country can be disorienting, but for one Argentine girl who moved to Texas, the Fab Four kept her grounded.
Welcome to Beatle News!
It was 1998, years before podcasts were a thing.
Beatle News!
One emigre's magical mystery tour, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. One man was a white supremacist, another a Muslim supremacist. That's how he refers to himself. A small group called Parents for Peace brought them together. The two men talked about how they were led down similar paths to extremism and how they got out. Now they're helping others. Here's The World's Shirin Jafari.
Not so long ago, it would have been impossible to imagine Mubin Sheikh and Chris Buckley in a room together. Sheikh was a Muslim supremacist, Buckley a member of the Ku Klux Klan. But on a recent Sunday afternoon, the two men stand side by side, addressing a group of students and their parents at an Islamic center outside of Boston. This is part of what they do with a group called Parents for Peace. On this particular Sunday, they're giving two presentations. They talk about their painful personal stories, about what made them join and later quit extremist groups. Mubin Sheikh, the former Muslim supremacist, is sporting a skull cap and a short beard. He goes first.
So I'm from Indian background. My parents are from India. Born and raised in Toronto, Canada.
In Canada, Sheikh went to an Islamic school as well as the regular public school. Two very different experiences, he says. In one, he was taught about strict Islamic rules. In the other, girls and boys mixed. They went to house parties. It all left him confused and conflicted about his identity.
Who am I? What kind of a Muslim am I? How Muslim can I be and how Canadian can I be?
Maybe some traveling would help him find answers, he thought. So he went, first to India and then to Pakistan, where he met members of the Taliban.
So now there's this 18-year-old kid seeking a new identity through religion, sees these guys, and they seem macho, right? Like they're like the tough guys, right? Like, yeah, and I was like, I want to be like these guys.
The Taliban left an impression on Sheikh. When he returned to Canada, he embraced Wahhabism, an ultra-conservative form of Islam. Sheikh says the strict dogmatic mentality really got into his head.
Whenever I would take the bus, I would see the synagogue, and I thought to myself, you know, how can I blow this place up?
He didn't blow any place up. And in fact, when 9/11 happened, he wondered if he truly understood his religion.
That's what really kind of pushed me to say, you know, I understand, you know, fighting for Islam and whatever that means, but flying planes into buildings didn't make sense to me. So I decided, you know what, I need to study Islam.
2 years of re-educating himself, Sheikh was a transformed man. He renounced Wahhabism, became a counter-terrorism expert, and today he works with Parents for Peace. Now, we'll get to Chris Buckley, the Klansman, in a minute. But first, there's a person that connects the two men. Miriam Churchill is the executive director of Parents for Peace. She tells me that personal, first-hand experiences like those of Sheikh and Buckley's inform the work they do.
Our members are also former extremists from all kind of different ideology, former neo-Nazi, former Muslim supremacists, former Antifa and others, and survivor of violent extremism.
Parents for Peace started in 2015. It was created by relatives of Carlos Bledsoe. He converted to Islam and in 2009 opened fire on a military recruiting office in Arkansas. He killed one soldier and wounded another. He's serving a life sentence. The attack left the Bledsoe family in shock, says Churchill, and they had no one to turn to.
It's an issue that is so much misunderstood that often families find themselves struggling with shame and not being able to find resources and help.
Churchill says over time she's noticed a pattern.
As we were helping families, we start to see a very similar narrative. People of different religion, different color, and yet the same story. A young person that is vulnerable with underlying issues that are being exploited by recruiters.
The group set up a hotline that families can call if they need help. No judgment. Back at the event, it's Chris Buckley's turn to take the mic. He's a bit taller than Sheikh and has tattoos all over his knuckles and forearms.
So my name is Chris Buckley, and I did 13 years in the United States Army and was deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq in the war on terrorism.
Buckley grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. He says he had a difficult childhood. His parents used racist slurs at home. At school, he was bullied.
I was that angry kid that was just like, I just want to fight everybody, you know? And my dad got really nervous because he was like, you're going to end up in prison or dead.
At 17, Buckley got into the military. He says he was so angry, he just wanted to blow things up. He was deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq, but the war only added to his anger, he says. Like when he saw his friend and fellow service member get killed right in front of him in Afghanistan.
This is the common interaction I had with Islam. It was negativity. It was kill or be killed. So I got to experience Islam. I got to experience Muslims through a very narrow lens in my life.
When Buckley came home, he felt lost. He started drinking, got addicted to painkillers and meth. He went online to find a community, and he found the KKK. There is this video clip of Buckley online. It's from a documentary that didn't air. It was so controversial. It shows Buckley and his young son dressed in KKK outfits.
You're a white supremacist?
Yeah, absolutely.
In 2016, Buckley's wife was done with her husband's behavior. She looked online for help and eventually found Parents for Peace.
And like that began a painstaking, brutal transformation in me. Like, bro, you gotta get sober, man. And once I did, I realized that I reverted back to the highest level of training I received. I reverted back to my military values.
That's when Buckley met Mubin Sheikh. For the first time, Buckley was having real conversation with a Muslim. He says it made him realize how much he'd misunderstood Islam.
And every religion tells us to love each other. So let's love each other.
Buckley is now working on a new program that helps extremists break away from hate groups.
So, like, thank you for having me. This is truly amazing, and like, I look forward to the Q&A session. So,
until now, Parents for Peace has stayed out of the spotlight. It has refused to take government money, and it insists on being apolitical. But its members are not shy about what families and communities are up against. Here's Miriam Churchill again.
We are experiencing a national crisis, and we are extremely worried.
Worried, she says, because groomers are actively searching for and recruiting young people into extremist groups. That's why she wants to partner with those closest to them, parents, teachers, school nurses, and pediatricians.
No one was born a supremacist. No one woke up one day and said, I'm going to be a neo-Nazi or I'm going to be a Muslim supremacist. That just doesn't exist.
Churchill says she wants people to know that there are resources out there. And that, as the stories of Mubin Sheikh and Chris Buckley show, there is always a way out. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Now to the Middle East, where a new list is turning up the heat. On it, 112 companies that have business ties to Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Most countries, as well as the United Nations, view the settlements as illegal. Rupert Colville is a spokesperson with the UN Human Rights Office.
It's important to note that it is not, as some claim, a blacklist, nor does it qualify any company's activities as illegal.
So why issue the report in the first place? In 2016, the Palestinians and some Muslim-majority nations requested it. Having a list allows activists to see what companies are operating in the West Bank, then boycott them. Most of the companies are Israeli. Others are large international firms like Motorola, Airbnb, and Booking.com. The Israeli government called the new list a shameful surrender to those who want to hurt Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, whoever boycotts us will be boycotted. As for the Palestinians, Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki called the new list a victory for international law. He said if countries have companies on the list, their governments should force them to cut ties. Rupert Colville with the UN says what happens next is up to individual nations.
The report recommends that if states wish to follow up on this, they should consider setting up an independent expert body to take this work forward.
Today, some companies like U.S.-based General Mills defended itself for being on the list. In an email sent to us, General Mills said it produces bread and croissants at a factory at an Israeli industrial park in the West Bank. The company says around 50% of its employees are Palestinian, with a high record of employee satisfaction. I think you're going to fall in love with this next story. It comes to us from reporter Lucia Benavides. When she was a girl, Lucia and her family moved from Argentina to Texas. She says her adjustment to the States was made easier thanks to four guys from Liverpool.
Valerie Jenin was my first friend in the United States. We met just months after I moved to Austin, Texas. I was 9 years old and she lived down the street. And just like me, she loved the Beatles.
Welcome to Beatle News!
It was 1998, years before podcasts were a thing. Our studio was my parents' living room. We recorded our radio program over a few years, using a cassette player with a mic. Our audience was small, just us. Our focus was constant, the Beatles.
Now, today there's something sad we need to tell you. About George Harrison.
We reported on the latest news, including when an intruder attacked George Harrison and his wife in 1999, nearly killing them.
It was December 30th, morning 4 a.m.
Most of the program, though, was us singing. Maybe you can hear my accent. and I didn't know all the words I was saying. Back in Argentina, I sang along with the Beatles by making up words or mimicking their pronunciation. But when my parents moved me and my brothers to Texas, I was instantly surrounded by English. The only thing that seemed to exist both in Argentina and the U.S. were four mop tops from Liverpool.
Hey, Lucy, I got a surprise for you.
What is it?
It's a song from the Beatles, I mean.
What is it called, the song?
It's called Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Here it goes.
The Beatles have always felt like home, but there's never been a place that I've felt a part of. I always introduce myself as Argentine, but when I go to Argentina, I don't get certain references and sometimes make mistakes in Spanish. But I also don't feel like I belong to the U.S. There's always some small cultural difference, or the fact that I eat dinner at 10 p.m. But I'm not alone in feeling this way.
My name is Santiago Benavides. No, perdón.
I called up my brothers, Santiago and Emiliano, or Santi and Emi. They're twins and were 6 years old when we moved to Texas. Now they're 28. Santi is a physicist and Emi a translator. He speaks 10 languages. We still speak Spanish with each other, but switched to English for the interview.
I get obsessed with like other countries and other languages, and I think in a way, I want to belong.
I mean, yeah, I have the same feeling. In a way, it's also more interesting, I think, to kind of have like a mix of different backgrounds and stuff like that. And
but do you think that you'll ever feel like you belong somewhere?
I do think like I belong, but it's not a nationality. It's like my life choices, right? Of like being a scientist and like my
home can be something you create for yourself, but I guess I'm still trying to figure out what that means for me. For a long time, music was my identity, but now it's veered into storytelling.
Welcome to Beatle News.
Our voices are so high.
20 years later, Valerie and I are still in touch. She still lives in Texas, where she directs a choir and sings professionally now. I'm far away in Barcelona.
It's like funny because I don't remember specifically how much English you actually spoke. All I just remember is that like we seemed to get along.
But like how much do you remember it being like the Beatles, like the thing that we had in common?
Oh no, that was a huge part of it because like that was like our thing.
You know, Valerie, I've never thought of this, but
are you recording?
Yeah, but.
That's towards the end of Beatle News. I was 12 by then, my accent completely gone. We were still trying to figure out who we were, our likes, our dislikes, our looks.
We're really lucky that we have music. You know, back 100,000 million years ago, dinosaurs didn't have music, and all they could do is walk around and eat plants. But now
we have bangs either.
And now we have pop, rock, rap, whatever you can think of.
And bangs.
And thanks to the Beatles, people wear bangs.
Yeah,
like me.
I was trying to make my point.
During that time, the Beatles gave me a home, a way to connect. Or at the very least, the Beatles gave us bangs. For the world, Lucia Benavides, Barcelona.
Ooh, take it a baby now. Twist and shout. Twist and shout.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. After more than a decade of being a wanted man, Sudan's former president may finally face his day in court. Omar al-Bashir was overthrown last year, and now the new government in Sudan says it will hand over Bashir to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. He stands accused of genocide and crimes against humanity. As many as 300,000 people were killed on his watch in the Darfur region of Sudan. A government militia known as the Janjaweed is blamed for many of those deaths. The BBC's Mohamed Hashim is one of the first journalists to travel freely around Darfur in a decade and reports that the legacy of the Janjaweed still hangs over the region.
These were the defining chants of the revolution.
thousands of Darfuri activists took part in the uprising that ousted Bashir. Activists like Bumban.
The revolution was all over Sudan, yet the government targeted Darfuris. They used us as scapegoats to distract attention from the protests. They called us all sorts of things, including terrorists and infiltrators. But the protesters stood up to Bashir. They told him he was an arrogant racist and that everyone supported Darfur.
Bumban left the camp he was living in and came to Khartoum to take part in the uprising. But what about those left behind in Darfur? To find out, I went to Niala, the capital of South Darfur and the country's second largest city.
Last time I was here was in 2007-08. The camp was new then and it was very insecure. There were many incidents being reported and the government used to attack the camp regularly. Now, it feels like a safe settlement. It feels like a city which has its markets where people are getting on about their daily lives.
We went to visit Kalma, the largest of Darfur's 175 camps. Kalma is a sprawling camp perched on the edges of the desert, surrounded by glades of baobab, and a solitary train track to nowhere runs past the camp. Nearly 2 million Darfuris were forced to flee their homes during the war, and they have lived in camps like Kalma ever since. People like Ilyas, a volunteer teacher by day and a barber in the afternoon. Ilyas was 19 when he came to Kalma in 2004. He wore the scars of war on his face.
One of the Janjaweed fighters saw that I was from a different area. He called me a slave, and another soldier pushed me, and I fell face first into the fire.
For people like Ni'mat, an IDP who's trained as a midwife, things haven't changed.
The situation is not improving. Things improve when there is work, and people here have no work. People here mostly work on other people's farms on day-by-day basis. Whatever you make, that is your children's sustenance. They said the new government will make things better, but we've not seen any changes.
We're about to go and introduce ourselves to the local sheikhs who oversee this camp.
The sheikhs were adamant they will not go back to their homes until conditions improved.
So Sheikh Ishaq just made the demands of the people in this camp. They want the handing over of former President Bashir to the ICC and his cohorts. He is calling for the disarmament of all the Janjaweed forces. He wants resettlement in the villages where they were displaced from. And he says all the foreign settlers who have made them prisoners in their own land have to return to their countries.
Back in Niala, any visitor to the cities in Darfur can see the rapid support for soldiers. The rebranded Janjaweed, some of them have served in Yemen, or we're heading there. They bring in money. This is evident in the urban sprawl of cities like Niala and Al-Fashir, where the markets are booming and vehicles smuggled from Libya fill up the dusty lanes. When I ask people about how they see them, many avoided answering directly. But the recent spat of ethnic violence in Western Darfur shows how volatile the region still remains. If the revolution to oust Bashir is to mean anything, people here tell me the crimes perpetrated in Darfur must not go unpunished.
The BBC's Mohamed Hashim there reporting from Darfur in Sudan. A pile of old mattresses isn't exactly the image of prosperity unless you look at them in a radically new way, says Professor Tony Ryan with the University of Sheffield in England.
The first time we came, it was all about how can we deal with all this stuff? What can we turn it into?
The stuff he's talking about is a pile of 10,000 old foam mattresses at Zaatari, a Syrian refugee camp in Jordan. Ryan traveled there on a sustainability mission.
I'd sent the most excited text message home.
We're going to be able to grow stuff all over. We'll be able to turn these beds into green beds and everyone can have their own garden.
Everyone can have their own garden. Ryan is helping people grow food by using old foam mattresses in place of soil. Because at the refugee camp, a normal garden with soil is not really an option. 80,000 people live there, and there isn't room for each family to have their own plot of land. And the desert soil is too poor to cultivate anything. So bring in the mattresses.
Growing things in a tub with polyurethane foam, the foam just holds the plant upright. All the other functions of the soil come from the nutrients in the water, and the foam allows the roots to do their thing.
Ryan adds that this unconventional method uses just 20% of the water that it would take to grow something in the ground because the water isn't going anywhere. The UN Refugee Agency is helping teach people how to garden with these recycled foam mattresses. People like Mohammed Dimafouz.
It makes me feel like I'm in my home village back in Syria. My whole family works with me on this. This knowledge we can share with our children, so one day they can benefit from it and share it with their own children.
The Za'atari refugee camp now has an area the size of a tennis court covered in these new gardens. But Professor Ryan said the mattress method could solve problems far beyond this refugee camp, as cities everywhere face food threats from a hotter, drier climate.
We could all end up living like this. You know, as climate change plays out, who knows what's going to happen?
Well, for one thing, it'll keep a bunch of foam mattresses out of the landfills. Smart, with so many benefits. Check out the mattress gardens for yourself on our Instagram. We are at PRI The World. And that's going to do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.